This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, see you on the picket line with the great actor, singer, and social justice activist, Harry Belafonte. But first...
Union strength, aside from what it means for the individual member in grievance procedures and wage and benefit packages, carries great meaning for the advocates of capital accumulation. For the political party that particularly champions wealth concentration, the Republicans, they bitterly remember in 2008 that $400 million was spent by organized labor on ads and get-out-the-vote campaigns in support of efforts to elect President Barack Obama and other Democrats. This, among other class-oriented positions by the labor movement, has certainly evoked the ire of the Republican juggernaut who is determined to break the back of unions. And currently, the bulk of union strength is in the public sector. 36% of public sector workers are unionized, while less than 7% of private sector workers are unionized. So now the nation's eye is trained on Wisconsin's aggressive governor, Scott Walker's efforts to emasculate the public sector unions. While similar efforts are in Ohio and Indiana and Pennsylvania, and they're all poised for action, we're joined by Frank Emspach, Executive Director of Workers Independent News and Director Emeritus of the School for Workers of the University of Wisconsin. And good morning, Frank.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, what I want to begin with is looking at a lot of the legal implications. For example, under collective bargaining agreements, really, what is the legality of Governor Walker's refusal, for example, to negotiate over anti-union legislation? And hasn't there even been a filing on this point with the an unfair labor practice with the state's Labor Relations Board?
Yes, there are several things going on here. First of all, current law. Current law requires collective bargaining on issues of hours, wages, and working conditions. So the governor has said, a huge headline in the paper, but also said it directly, no negotiations. So the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers has said this is in violation of current law and is seeking to force the governor into negotiations currently. Because what he did is, after announcing no negotiations, and after the unions agreed to take concessions equal to the budget deficit, this three-month deficit. Not only did he refuse to negotiate, right, he then canceled all the contracts, which he could do because the contracts had expired. So as of March 14th, there are no state union contracts. So that's one aspect. The second is prospective. Are the state laws that he is proposing legal? Well, we don't know that, except that in general, labor law has supported negotiations over wages, hours, and working conditions, particularly working conditions. And in the proposed law, there would be no negotiations. Those issues would be disallowed, and so negotiations could only take place over wages. And even there, the only discussion can be the wages that would be equal to the cost of any increase.
Well, what about the issue of the constitutionality of, for example, that this intrudes upon the city's home rule authority, for example, over its pension plan?
Well, we have state workers involved here and county and municipal workers involved, and the law in Wisconsin differentiates. In any case, the home rule aspects are very important. The home rule aspect is very simple. The cities have the responsibility for negotiating about pensions for their city and municipal workers. In the current law, this is the case. In the prospective law, this is not the case. And so the city of Milwaukee has begun filing the process of filing a lawsuit claiming that that this current the prospective law is in violation of the state's constitution and hence is invalid. So there's a lawsuit going on over that. But this law that's proposed goes far beyond collective bargaining. And so there are all kinds of other aspects that are in the process of being investigated, where lawsuits have been announced. And I think we're going to see legally what happens. But, of course, there's also this motion that was passed by the South Central Federation of Labor, which is like the New York Central Labor Council, basically authorizing the organization, the delegates, to investigate the possibilities of a strike and to educate members and local leadership as to what the consequences of that might be.
Well, indeed, what do you think the consequences or the punishment might be since there is a prohibition on the striking of workers? I don't know. Is it that covered by the Taft-Hartley agreement?
It's private. Taft-Hartley is private sector and interstate commerce. So, no. But in the state of Wisconsin, starting in 1935, when public sector bargaining laws began to be passed here, each of them says that striking by public sector workers in whatever jurisdiction the law covers is illegal. But in any kind of strike in the public sector, and almost all over the United States, unlike other countries, the striking in the public sector is illegal. The net result, however, is a little different. In Wisconsin, there have been a large, significant number of public sector strikes. They have always occurred when public sector workers have been denied the right to bargain. In other words, they're working, and they want to have a union, which is fine. You can always unionize, but you don't have to. The employer does not have to bargain. So you can have a union, but you have a great deal of problem being effective because the employer can say, we don't want to talk to you. In Wisconsin, in the 60s, there were two strikes and in the public sector, and that got us the first graduate student union, the Teaching Assistants Association. After the second strike, the powers that be decided enough is enough. In the 70s, it was the same story. Municipal workers in Wisconsin, including teachers, had the right to bargain, but nobody had to listen to them. And so we did not have any kind of serious discussions in many, many places. Effectively, what happened was the workers were disenfranchised. So between 1976 and 1979, there were about 110 work stoppages, issues, strikes, whatever, at the city level. And so finally in 1978-79, we got the Municipal Employment Relations Act, which of course forbids strikes, but also imposed arbitration and a method of settlement if the parties could not reach agreement. And since then, we haven't had any kind of upheaval like that. And again, from the city's point of view and the public's point of view, that's a good system. And the workers' point of view, because you were enfranchised, you had rights, they were enforceable, and so forth. Now, under the proposed law, all that goes out the window. And so, when you're talking about a strike in the public sector, generally, since the objective is to get someplace and to settle, often these become political issues. And if most of the population is with the workers, the settlement is usually something everybody can live with, and there aren't tremendous consequences in terms of discharges and huge fines and so forth. If it's unpopular, if people really feel in the public that they have been preyed upon in some fashion, then there's usually very serious consequences.
One of the things that I also want to look at, which many people haven't focused on, are issues within the context of the legislation, such as the distribution of assets and the legality and the implications of that, and certainly also change in the health care litigation. Please enlighten us on those.
Well, this is a so-called budget repair bill, which means that you're supposed to be fixing the budget for a short period of time, not reorganizing state government. And so in the law here, there's a whole series of regulations and proposals to change the way in which state government works, which obviously, in a narrow sense, has very little to do with the fiscal money situation. So the two that are focused on most, because I think they're easiest to understand, is one, a proposal to for the state to sell state assets. The leading candidates here are power plants owned by the state, and the idea is to sell them in a no-bid proceeding with little legislative or any other kind of oversight to whoever wants them, I guess. And this has caused a big hue and cry because it's not only state assets, but it's state forests, whatever. And in a no-bid situation, you're basically, the possibility is you're selling them at below market to your friends, of course. And so that has raised a whole host of issues with legislators, including the issues of legislative oversight. So people are looking about suing there. Then with health care, we have Badger Care. Badger Care is like Medicare for under low-income people, and it's a pretty comprehensive system. So far, it has worked very well. There's not huge deficits, but the proposal is to replace the current management of this plan with an appointed board, appointed by the governor, of three people who will then decide how the plan will be administered, what kind of procedures are going to be covered, and so on and so forth. And there, legislators are saying, wait a minute, we have a law in place that requires legislative oversight, and you're taking it away. So there's a structural issue here that will also become the focus of litigation should this whole thing pass. So you got all kinds of different types of issues here, but they all get down to this. Every single one of the proposals either reduces the wealth that the state of Wisconsin has or reduces the wages or the benefits available to working people.
You know, one of the things that at least we should highlight is the fact that there was a significant victory in enjoining really Scott Walker from proceeding to the limitations of freedom of speech and assembly. So just tell us about that, because at least there's something particularly affirmative that in the pushback and struggle for the maintenance of workers' rights.
Well, we have a state capitol that's a beautiful place. It looks like the one in Washington, D.C. It's granite, it's lovely, but it's also conceived here as the people's house. People are quite proud of this. I mean, there's a Christmas tree in there. At Christmas time, there's a huge farmer's market that goes around the state capitol starting in about a month. And it's, it attracts hundreds of thousands of people. And so it's something that's really used all the time, and people like it. So on Monday, I guess Valentine's Day, the Student Teaching Assistants Association, we're going to give Valentine's to the governor. He was out, so they stayed for the last 2 weeks in the state house, and the governor has moved to remove the people. His Republican friends passed a law basically closing the state house on starting last Thursday, and the police essentially refused to enforce it. So the other night, there was another move to get rid of people, and the prior attorney general filed in federal court to get an injunction. Saying that, A, the law was not unconstitutional in the state, and B, it's the people's house and nobody has the right to throw them out. And a judge agreed with her reasoning so far and issued a temporary restraining order saying that the governor could not throw people out of the state capitol. And that's where it stands now. Although there are increasing efforts to limit access and make it difficult. But still, the central point was one, people are there, nobody's leaving.
Well, the labor movement is the only vehicle that really gives a voice to workers as a class in the legislative process. Obviously, there has to be a continuing protection of the rights. We'll continue to explore these issues as they come up in other states. And Frank Emsbach, thanks for the work that you do. Thank you for enlightening and explaining some of these things to us. It's been a pleasure.
Ain't nobody ever got nothing that didn't raise a voice. Not the steelwork in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Wisconsin.
to here. Everybody has to stand up in their place where they live and always remember, no matter what Governor Walker, the Mubarak of the Midwest, says, this land is your land. But the wheel of history is in your hands. Our communities, our cities, and our country will be like. So it's an honor to stand shoulder to shoulder in solidarity with you today, our good friends in Madison, Wisconsin. So allow your eyes and ears to be revolutionized by what's been going on in your fair city, and head out to confront injustice every single day on the streets, and never give up and never give in on this issue, please. But also for the next minute or so, we're going to have a good time. I'm sorry if there's any children in the audience, but the struggle for justice is not always rated PG-13. And together, we're going to sing "This Land Is Your Land" as loud as anyone has ever sung it. Let them hear you in the state capitol, and let them hear you in the streets of Cairo. Together we sing loudly, and everybody jumps up when I say, all right, we ready?
All right!
In the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, near the relief office, I see my people.
Yeah.
Some are grumbling, and all are wondering, if this land's still made for you and me. Tell them!
Yeah!
And that was Tom Morello in Madison, Wisconsin, with the protesters for union rights. And now, in his recent speech at City College in New York City, Harry Belafonte decries what has been the passivity in the U.S. in face of massive attacks on civil rights and workers' rights, but welcomes the recent protests against tyranny in Tunisia and Egypt and extending to Madison, Wisconsin, to protect workers' rights.
In a few days, I'll be 84. What bothers me at this moment, I've seen too many young black men and women in the prisons of America that came from the streets I knew. And as long as there was this fact that America had the largest prison population in the world, and that the most of that population were made up of people of color and immigrants, there was something to be done. And in that context, I began to take a much deeper look at the problems of women and rape and violence, beatings and drugs, and it goes on and on. But I always felt that we would rise to the cause, because after all, that was our history. But I was thrown severely when I looked at Katrina and I saw what happened to the poor, and in the midst of the poor, the large and inordinate number of black people that were caught, and the fact that nobody cared enough about the plight of our fellow human beings to change it. Nobody stepped into the fray to say, you're not going to get away with this. There was no echoes of the past ringing loudly in the streets of New Orleans. What had happened to black people? How did we become suddenly so silent? Where did we fail? Now, there is some reward because I looked at Cairo. I looked at tens of thousands of people of color rise up against oppressors who were of color and who nonviolently overthrew the wicked. And although they may not know exactly where they're going from here, they know where they have been and where they will not go again. And the same thing is happening in Libya, and the same thing has happened in Tunisia, where it started, and in Yemen, and you can go on and on. But hello, all of a sudden, there was Wisconsin. People in Wisconsin are doing what? They're in the streets, oppressing. Is the name of the game. They don't want their unions destroyed and their jobs taken away. And this is in Wisconsin. Wow. And most of them are white. God moves in mysterious ways. We all have something to do. The question is, will we do it? Unless you have a citizenry, if you have a people who are not engaged and going out and making the power elite address our concerns and changing the canvas, you will forever be doomed to the misery of poverty, second-class citizenship, and denial of your dignity. The noisemakers are getting their day. The banks, Wall Street, everybody is getting a piece of it except us. We're not demanding. Let me make this observation. Our ignorance about a lot of things is not solely out of our own complacency. Is not solely out of our own indifference. There is a machine out here that has a vested interest in your ignorance. There's a machine out here that has a vested interest in letting our young believe that the civil rights movement is no longer relevant. There's a machine out here that keeps us absent of a certain level of truth and information that should have long been in our understanding. What happened in Cairo was that the same victims of that which I have just described found that wall torn down, because if it had not been for the Facebook, if it had not been for the internet, if it had not been for something that could give people access to information in ways they never had it before, there could have been no rebellion. And I think we have to have a deeper understanding of how insidious the mechanisms of our oppression have become. There are no more signs that say, no niggers here. There are no more signs that say, for colored only. There are no more signs that say a lot of things that were easy in our time to see. Our children don't have that as an in-your-face experience. But they have something else. They have the Tea Party. They have a force out here that don't like immigrants and don't want there to be an integration. They have a force out here that's cutting off any aid to anybody who dares talk about HIV and AIDS. There's a system out here that's more insidious than any system we have ever known. There is a Republican hierarchy that represents only the tip of the iceberg in Wisconsin. Because it isn't just that governor by himself. It is a conspiracy among the powerful and the elite, with billions of dollars have been poured into this fact. They're going to break the back of labor, break the back of collective bargaining, break down the rights of a worker to have a decent wage. They're on a campaign. They already destroyed the Democratic Party. You can't be a liberal in this country without running for some place to hide in shame. Now they're coming after workers. I mean, it's like it was before. Tyranny is on the march. We have to wake up. We have to get with it. We have to understand that there's not much room left to breathe here. You can look at television all you want. It makes you mindless. Thank you. Thank you for coming. See you on the picket line.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.